Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and thank you for joining us. Every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., we archive these programs, the podcasts, at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. We also stream live at richarddugan.com, and we encourage you also to go to our guest's website. We will be giving you the link to our guest's website here in just a little bit, but we encourage you to stay with us. This program is, I'm going to say, sort of dedicated to some of the folks that I have associated with over the years, especially in my early career, but also folks such as my ex-wife, who I grew, obviously, to know and love, hence the marriage, and that hasn't really changed. But at the same time, there are aspects of our lives, and even in my own life, where I experienced certain disconnects, if you will, not on my part per se, although I suppose I went the opposite direction that most would have under the circumstances. I became more of, I guess it's kind of obvious, isn't it, that I kind of became an extrovert, isn't it? Yet there are other folks who become introverts and just say, you know, fine, if you don't want to have anything to do with me, then I'll just, retreat into my, so to speak, tortoise shell, and I'll just go about my daily business and not bother anybody and just have a fairly good life and what have you. And a lot of this is based upon what I titled, and we'll get our guest's interpretation of this as well, perceived limitations. As you've heard many, many times on this program, I was born legally blind, had a lens implant at the age of 38, and found myself in 2006 driving through L.A. traffic. Yes, driving. I was actually driving and was rather amazed. It was like I didn't think about it at first when we entered Los Angeles. Then I started looking around and I'm going, I'm out here in the middle of the freeway. That's pretty cool. Not expected, but pretty cool. But it comes down to, as I said before, perceived limitations. If they are limitations, then they're limitations. But if they aren't, then guess what? You get to do pretty much anything you want to do, and our guest is going to talk about that. He is going to be talking about it from the perspective of taking your place at the table, the art of refusing to be an outsider. And I want to welcome J.B. Joseph to our program. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I guess we should start out by letting our listeners know why there is this somewhat connection. First of all, I must tell you that my ex-wife was born and raised with a cerebral palsy, which is also the same condition that you have.
Correct. So I did not know, we might as well just dive right into it. I did not know that I was disabled until I was 12, which I guess is the framework for the book. I found out that I was disabled because somebody told me, somebody in the media decided to tell me that I was not allowed to go to the same school as my sister, and I had no logical reason why that was true other than there was a law in Canada that said that anybody born with a major disability in 1969 could not go to a regular school, and it didn't add up for me, so I asked some questions. I have cerebral palsy. It's like being a catcher and stealing, second base, meaning the element of surprise. People believe that because you live with a disability that you're disabled, mm-hmm. and that's just not accurate. So you can be disabled because you live with a disability, but they're not mutually exclusive.
And I know that there are folks out there who do get caught up in, and rightly or wrongly so, they get caught up in semantics. And some would say, well, but JB, you aren't disabled. You have a disability, as if that makes a big difference. I was born legally blind. According to all of the eye charts that they placed before me as I was a kid growing up, I had 2200 in the right, 2400 in the left. And that constituted legal blindness. Even though I was able to walk around, I wore those thick bottle-bottom glasses and that kind of stuff. Large print books. I had some textbooks were recorded. It was one of those situations where I was even bicycling to and from school. You know, I could see well enough, you know, and I, even as I got older, closer to 16 and 17 and 18, you know, driving age, I said, wait a minute. I said, I probably do a heck of a lot better because I drive defensively. I'd probably do better than most of the drivers out there. Well, you know, unbeknownst to me at the time, I was going to get that chance at the age of 38. In terms of Canada's regulations and laws, do you folks in Canada now have, or does Canada, I should phrase it that way, does Canada have the equivalent of the American Disabilities Act, the ADA?
So let me say, the easy answer is no. The best piece of legislation, hands down, is the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it's the best piece of legislation for people with disabilities to maximize their independence anywhere in the world, and especially anywhere in North America. And the reason is as follows. It forces you. In other words, there's no prejudice. It forces you to hire a person with a disability to get a job if they meet the requirements for that job, regardless of their appearance or their limitations. In other words, the fact that an employee needs adaptive devices to maximize their independence does not keep them out of the workforce. So, no, there is no other law like that that I know of anywhere in the world. Canada has something known as the National Strategy for the Integration of Disabled Persons. That's a nice law, or it's a nice strategy, but it doesn't force you to hire someone with a disability if they have the aptitude for the job. It doesn't automatically remove the bias that able-bodied individuals have against people with disabilities just because they're not willing to take the time to learn about them, if that makes any sense.
No, I absolutely agree. And see, that's one of the interesting dichotomies that I find when people propose certain laws, regardless of what the law is for, and especially if it's in an attempt to change the hearts and the minds of the citizens, the law is irrelevant if you don't change the hearts and the minds. The law isn't going to do that. That has to be done at a different level. And I'm going to guess that even to this day, that's in spite of social media, in spite of the internet, in spite of all of the great technological advances that we have to spread the word about being more understanding and compassionate and considerate of, there are still people who the last thing they want in their workplace or in their living space or wherever is someone who is not, as the term goes, able-bodied.
Correct. That's true. The question that people should ask themselves that I like to bring up, and I bring it up in my book and Taking It to the Table, is the question you have to ask yourself is how come, you know, George Bush, Papa Bush, created the Americans with Disabilities Act? And the answer is very simple, because necessity is the mother of invention. He had a personal story, and he called in 48 attorney generals, and he said, write a law that makes sense, right? And that's how it works. The only way you're going to learn about people with disabilities, the only way you're going to learn about people who are different than you, right, is to spend time with them. So your listeners might say, well, I don't want to spend time with them. But my dear friend, there's only two kinds of people in the world. You can only be able-bodied or disabled. And I have a newsflash for our listeners. Just because you're able-bodied today doesn't mean you don't become disabled tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's non-discriminatory. So the best way to get ahead of the curve, if you will, is to accept the fact that those are the only two kinds of individuals that exist, you know, in this hemisphere. So that's what I would say.
Now,
that's what I would say.
As obviously, as you were approaching this one monumental event at the age of 12, as far as schooling is concerned, there wasn't any problem per se up to that point. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, let me backtrack. I was 6 when I decided to walk into Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau's office in Ottawa and ask him why I wasn't allowed to go to the same school as my sister.
Okay.
You see, when you're young, you don't have time to think, well, 6-year-olds don't walk into the Prime Minister's office. and ask how come I can't go into the same school as my sister. And that was the greatness of my father, is that when I said I wanted to meet with the prime minister, he didn't say, what, are you out of your mind? He said, when do you want to go? And I said, how about right now? And we got in the car and we drove to Ottawa, which is about 90 minutes from Montreal. And as luck would have it, you know, you walk around Parliament Hill with your shorts on and your braces and you're so cute. And, oh, look at that cute kid with his dad. And it just kept walking and walking and walking. And before you knew it, office of the prime minister. And we walked right in and I asked for an immediate meeting. And guess what? Because I had nothing to lose, I got it. It took 5 years to change the law to allow people with disabilities to become mainstream. But again, I didn't do this to be like obnoxious or to make a statement. I was advocating for myself. Mm-hmm. No different than a parent advocates for their child, whether it has to be with disability rights, whether it has to be with the right to be in a particular, you know, sports team or dance club or book club. You know, that's what parents do, and that's what my dad did for me, and that's what I do today as a parent of four phenomenal children. So I didn't know. It wasn't on purpose, but it began when I was 6 years old, and then it became an issue when I was 12, when I wanted to go into a regular classroom, and that caused havoc, because up until then, from 1976 to 1981, they all allowed me to stay in a special ed class. But once I wanted to change the status quo of being in a regular classroom, in a regular school, that's when the media began to take sides. And they really would literally say, you know, JB's parents are not good parents. You know, he's going to set up for failure. And so there were two schools of thought. One school of thought was, you know, the government knows best. No one's ever done this. Don't do this, right? And the other school of thought, which is more to my liking, obviously, as a 12-year-old, is listen, give the kid a shot. If he makes it, we all win. And so that is kind of if I have to give a message to your listeners, that's the approach you should wake up with every morning. Give the kid a shot. I don't care if the kid's 22, 42, or 92. What do you care? You got nothing to lose.
Well, exactly. Our folks might be wondering why in the world would I have a gentleman like JB on the program where we deal with choices and knowledge of those choices. And I think it was very well said by you just a moment ago. Today, you listening, you might be able-bodied. You might be getting around and doing great and having lots of fun in your life. And tomorrow may be a whole different story, all because of something that may have happened that was not within your control. And, you know, we do have a lot of wonderful scientific advancements in this world these days, as far as the various gene therapies and these kinds of things. We can weed out a lot of the diseases and disabilities, but that has to be done before before the child is born. Okay, that can't be done after the fact. You know, it's like once the car is made, now all you can do is recall it for bad parts. Okay, or you know. But in this instance, and that was one of the interesting things for me, and I've been asked this, and I'm sure that this question's come up for you a number of times, and I've been asked, what's it like, you know, to be legally blind, or what's it like to be doing that? It was just the way it was. There was nothing special about it. It's just the way that it was. And for people who have whatever minor conditions might be, that's just the way that they live. It's a kind of an unusual question. It's like, okay, let me ask you, what's it like to be normal?
I give the same answer, by the way. I give the exact same answer. I don't know anything different.
Exactly. I'm curious, too, as to the process that you've been through, which has propelled you, into an area that... You know, you just have entered your 50s. I'm 57 now, and I'm still waiting for that 7 or 8 digit to figure in my bank account. You know, I'm still working on it, but I'm having a lot of fun working towards it anyway. But it's one of those things where, you know, you have provided what you refer to as, you know, this, you know, it might for some be an inspiring book. It might be encouraging and all those kinds of things. But from your perspective, this is the bottom line sort of practical guide, if you will, saying, look, you know, you want to play this game, if you will, or you want to sit at the table, you can, you know, but you have to be willing to do that work. I do have to say that a lot of the work was done for me in one sense. But at the same time, if I didn't step out and make the effort, I remember someone came up, when I first got into radio, the first thought I had was, how the heck am I going to queue up a turntable? How am I going to queue up a record? And within about 5 years, I could take and queue a record up within 5 to 10 seconds. And this is when the record is still in the library behind me in the shelf. I could pull the disc out, slap it down on the turntable, and cue it up to the cut I wanted within 10, maybe 10, 15 seconds. And it's a question of adapting. And that's also something that develops, I think, that also creates innovation in our technology as well. And sometimes it's not really high tech stuff. I'm in the process myself, JB, of constructing a ramp, but not for me, for my dog. My dog is elderly and has trouble going up these big concrete steps into the house, and I have to carry her in. And so I'm building this ramp so that she, under her own power, can walk right up into the house. Now, what I find interesting about ADA is that the benefits aren't just for those with disabilities. I like the ramp sometimes. You know, I don't have any real problems walking, but I, you know, if I don't have to take the steps sometimes, I'll take the ramp. You know, I enjoy that. I'm curious as to some of the innovations that you have discovered over the course of time that you find that folks kind of feel that way as well, that, you know, this isn't just for the disabled anymore kind of thing.
So I'm going to quote for you a cartoon that I once saw that's very telling. There's a snowstorm and after the snowstorm, there's snow all over the schoolyard, and there's a man who, you know, it's early morning, it's about, you know, I'm guessing, let's say 7:30 in the morning, and he's cleaning off the steps to the schoolhouse so that all the students can go in and get into class. And a gentleman or a student in the wheelchair says, "Sir, can you do the ramp so I can get up and get to school? And the custodian says, "Let me finish the steps first, and then I'll do the ramp." And the little boy says, "Sir, if you would have done the ramp first, then we can all get to class on time." So, I mean, that's just, you know, and that cartoon sticks in my mind, and I think answers your question.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yet, I find I get very frustrated, because there are still people out there who they don't want to have anything to do with ADA. They think that it's an intrusion. I don't know where they get this, but they get this feeling that it's like it's some kind of intrusion on their life in some way. And I have never been able to understand how anybody could be opposed to allowing other people freedom of access, you know, to anything. I had a... I'll share a really quick story here. Very interesting conversation that I had with a general manager of the Christian station that I worked for back in the 80s and early 90s. And it was at a time when a lot of conservatives wanted to stop Library of Congress from printing the Playboy, Hefner's magazine, in Braille. And, of course, uh-huh. You're only getting the words. You're not getting any pictures. I don't know what the problem
was. Right, right.
So, anyway, I basically, and I thought my argument was fairly lucid, I said to him, basically, you know, you and I, because I was buying books in bookstores, too, we can go into any bookstore, and we can look at the spine of a book, and we can make a determination based upon what we read there, or the color. I mean, they choose the particular designs and everything on books to attract attention for the whole, you know, I mean, it's all marketing. So if they've got my attention and I pull the book off the shelf and I start flipping through it, I choose to read it or not. I like this or no, I don't. I'm going to put it back. But what you are basically telling the blind and visually impaired who read Playboy via Braille is I am going to tell you what you can and cannot read. Now, I said, look, from the business standpoint, if Hefner is willing to make Braille Playboy available at the newsstand price to the blind and visually impaired, I say then go ahead and stop the funding. But since it's been going on for so many years, you're telling basically, again, you are telling the blind and visually impaired community what they can and cannot read. You are censoring them, and you are basically denying them their basic, I'm going to say basic human, forget civil, human rights of freedom of determination and choice. I was shocked that I actually won that argument with him. But it seems to me...
Yeah.
It seems to me like that's still going on even today.
Again, I don't know. The only thing I've heard negative about the Americans with Disabilities Act is like in every, you know, there are bad actors, you know, and so sometimes you get plaintiff attorneys who use it to their advantage because they're closed as competent, able-bodied professionals, but they can't make a living, and so they have deficits, and so they choose to sue businesses under the Americans with Disabilities Act. You know, they don't really have a plaintiff. They go and find a plaintiff, and then they sue a shopping center, or they sue a doctor's office, or they sue someone because the facility is not accessible to people with disabilities. That was not the intent of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and so I find people get upset because of that. Those are bad actors. Those are bad, and those are individuals who, again, who don't have at their core. They're not doing it for a sense of social justice or social advocacy or to make the world a better place. They're doing it because they can make a quick buck. And for those individuals, we don't represent them. The disabled community, using one voice, wants to make it unequivocally clear that that is not the reason that we tout the Americans with Disabilities Act as one of the greatest pieces of legislation. That is probably our only dark moment when you have attorneys who use it wrongfully. So that's the only negative that I've heard over the years. There are provisions in the Americans with Disabilities Act that religious institutions are exempt, right? And I write in my book that it is fantastic. It was one of the smartest when the drafters of the Americans with Disabilities Act created the exemption, you know, the exception to the rule that religious institutions would be exempt. That was genius, and the reason is very simple. You're not going to go around suing the Pope because the Archdiocese of Miami, and I don't know this to be true, I'm making this up, but because maybe the Archdiocese of Miami is not accessible to people with disabilities, or some particular church or temple or synagogue or mosque, you're not going to go through them. So therefore, if I take out the exception right here, right now, I've just made the law that much stronger. Now, don't confuse being exempt from doing the right thing. It just means that if you can't do it, I've made the law that much stronger. So I think it was really, really, really well thought out. I guess that's what happens when you put 48 attorney generals in one room. You get some pretty smart minds, both, you know, on the right side and on the left side. So that was very impressive.
Well, you'd like to think so, too. And it's one of those things where, I find it interesting, and I keep going back to this document on this program over and over again in the Declaration of Independence, where it talks about inalienable rights. And of these, and it wasn't just these, but of these, we have life, and we have liberty, but we don't have happiness. We can pursue it, but we can't. I don't know that we can necessarily have it, but we can pursue it. And I do use that sometimes tongue in cheek. But what I find interesting is the definition of life, as well as liberty. I don't have the freedom and liberty to move about this country and to access the various halls of learning, or institutions, and the list goes on. You know, if those are denied to me, then I don't have, you know, we talk about choices on this program. And if I tell you that you can choose this place over here, but you can't get in for whatever reason, whether it's through a bias or building codes, then there goes that choice. And it's like, but wait a minute, no, you can, but I can't get in. So I guess the first question that I want to ask you in regards to taking your place at the table, and again, this is about the art of refusing to be an outsider, is what's one of the first steps that we as individuals, and acknowledging that today I may be able-bodied, tomorrow not so much, what's the first step I need to take on this perceived long road to be able to sit at this table, to participate in the process, whatever that may be, and be to feel included?
So step number one is showing up. You'll be surprised. You know, we all go to certain tables that we're comfortable in. We all go to the table that I'm a physician or I'm a nurse or I'm a baseball player. I will migrate to tables that I'm comfortable with, right? My aptitude. But we don't go to a table. Let's say I wasn't invited somewhere and I really wanted to join this club or the civic organization or whatever it is. But we're not invited, so we don't show up. You'd be surprised, I write in my book, that if you show up 50% of the time and you show up to a table just by showing up, you're allowed to stay, and you could stay for years to come. So step number one is, if you know nothing else other than your own fear of not showing up, get rid of that fear and show up, because you'll probably be able to stay. So that's 50% of the time correct. The first thing that I would say is to show up to the table. That's what I would say as a simple rule. Now, let's take it one step further in case we have a listener. Sorry for my cough. In case we have a listener who says, well, but that's not realistic because I tried to show up to such and such a place and I just wasn't invited. So you've got to take a step back. Why weren't you invited? Was there a deadline? Was there an application process? You know, don't blame the institution or don't blame the denial on them. Are you intellectually honest that you didn't check off all the boxes that you were supposed to check off? Again, if our entire goal is to make you accessible, if our entire goal is to say, I'm as equal as you, I don't want to be an outsider, I refuse to be treated differently, right? And then by skipping steps and then expecting to be allowed into wherever you wanted to go and sit at that table, then you're breaking your own rule. So make sure that you're intellectually honest with yourself and that you follow all the steps. And that's, you know, and that was one of the reasons that you didn't get in, is because you didn't follow. And rule number three, it's no crime to ask for help.
I think that step is probably the most difficult, especially for folks who have disabilities.
Don't ask for directions. Why not? We drive around in circles. What's up with that? I don't know. Yeah. Sorry,
well, you know, if I get caught in a roundabout, it's okay. I can stay in there as long as I want.
Fair enough.
But I couldn't agree with you more in that respect. I have to say that maybe that's the reason why I felt so comfortable as I moved through my career. I mean, I started out working for a radio reading service for the blind and visually impaired. That was my very first radio job. And I was a client as well as an employee. And I met some incredible people. I even was connected with the Blind Center, as well as other organizations and agencies, and was around the folks that had visual impairments. And then when I moved to Santa Barbara and they had a recordings for the blind and dyslexic. And at first I go, what? That doesn't make any sense to me, because I didn't fully understand dyslexia. And once I did, that made perfect sense to me. Again, giving people access where they normally wouldn't have it. I mean, gosh, there's so much information out there, not only about, you know, getting access, but just information. If you're trying to do some study and some research into something, Good grief. Yeah, the libraries are full. There are bookstores, not to mention the internet. There's all kinds of stuff on there. I find that that's information that you have to really vet sometimes to make sure that it's going to work for you. But this is interesting. And, of course, you use the same sort of symbolism or analogy that we use on this program about we lay out a smorgasbord on our table and we encourage people to come and partake. Not of everything. That's ridiculous. You're not going to be able to, you're going to stuff yourself. We want you to come and take part of those things that resonate with you, that you like, if you will, or that are of interest to you, even partially. And quite honestly, I would think that for many people, this particular subject and this work that you've put out called Taking Your Place at the Table, they should be at least mildly interested in, even if they are able-bodied, because, again, I'm going to go back to what you already said before. Today, you may be able-bodied, but tomorrow, you may not. And you may be facing the same challenges and the same hurdles that folks who now have the condition you now have, they've been facing it for years, for decades. Is this something that I know that, you know, you started out dealing with the issues in Canada, and obviously we've talked about ADA and as far as the United States. How is this, shall we call it freedom of access? Is this available in the majority of the rest of the world? Or what is the attitude, I guess, is maybe the better question, the attitude around the rest of the world and other parts of the world, Europe and Asia and Africa and so forth, in regards to this particular issue? Because this is huge.
So the world is a big place. Let's take it down to the law. And the law is something that protects the United States. The law will be protected more often than not. The law... In the movie Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Tom Hanks is asked a question, and he's asked, "Do you like the law?" And he says, "I love the law. The law doesn't always work, and justice isn't always served. But when justice is served, the law works." So you don't know, it doesn't always work, but I would say that the law, you know, it says the Americans with Disabilities Act is just unparalleled, because the law tells you what to do. There's no ambiguity on how to maximize someone's independence. Then there's goodwill. For example, I don't think in Israel there's an Americans with Disabilities Act. But a lot of, you know, there is a mandatory draft in the state of Israel, and so therefore people come back hurt. And so there is these sensitivities. There is this awareness. People with disabilities who may have gone to war, able-bodied, and come home as husbands and brothers and sons with a disability. And so therefore, they have an incredible sensitivity to wheelchair basketball, to volleyball, to swimming, to Paralympics. Again, so there's no law, but there's an awareness, a very strong awareness. And then you need a place like Canada, who, to me personally, is the most concerning, because they have the national strategy for the integration of disabled persons. And I once wrote an op-ed. I don't know what that means. It's a lot of smoke and mirrors. In other words, you're a fantastic country. You tout yourself as having the best healthcare program, universal healthcare in the world. And you haven't taken the steps. Let's assume you started off with the national strategy for the integration of disabled persons. Your counterpart, the United States of America, has shown the incredible benefit of an actual law. How come they didn't go back to the drawing board to make it an actual law? So that's kind of the three ways that I would break it down. I don't know about Europe. I traveled. I went to Paris and I went to Amsterdam, and it's not so easy for a person with a disability to maximize their independence on their own. You know, Spain, I've been to Spain. Again, people just, I'll give you a small example. You walk into a restaurant, And the bathroom, right? They may have a stall. When they built the bathroom to the restaurant in Spain, there may actually be a stall that's accessible for people with disabilities. But to get into the actual bathroom, there's one step that no one paid attention to because it's an involuntary gesture for a able-bodied individual to go up the steps as opposed to a person with cerebral palsy who actually has to think about putting their foot down when they take a step down a flight of steps. So it's just small things like that. the beauty of the United States is that I know that I can travel anywhere in the United States. And for every airport, for every train station, for every bus depot, for every hotel, I'm going to find an elevator next to an escalator or steps. And that makes me independent. And so that's a big deal.
We're talking with JB. He's the author of Taking Your Place at the Table, The Art of Refusing to Be an Outsider. And the website is just that, takingyourplaceatthetable.com. We encourage you to check it out and get more information. Go to that website, read more about him and about the work that he has been doing. I'm also interested, too, JB, in this process you have been through, how this has changed you over the years, even if we can go back that far, even as far as the age of six to the present. And we'll do that when we come back from our break here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Stay with us.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan here with JB. He's written, I think it's a great practical guide for you for taking your place at the table. That is the name of the guide, the name of the book. It's also the website, add.com to that. We encourage you to check that out. Basically, while becoming a millionaire and a highly successful business leader, JB has fine-tuned the art of getting to the table. Now, getting to the table, that's one thing. But just because you want to be at the table, okay, you want to be there, does that necessarily mean that you know what the heck you're going to be doing once you get there? I mean, isn't that a sort of a one of the steps along the way that just, you know, if you're going to go to the table, you better be ready to, you better be ready to deal, so to speak. JB?
So basically, right, we talked about the first part about getting to the table. But just because you got to the table, it might not be what you wanted. You thought you were missing out. There are many, many individuals who begin a certain career. They think they want to become a dentist. And then they realize they want to become an attorney instead. Or they think they wanted to become a biology major because they were going to become a doctor. And they choose to become an accountant. I mean, that is what really happens in the real world to able-bodied students and professionals all the time. It's no different for a person with a disability. Again, we're allowed to change our mind. And so we get to the table and we realize this table is not for me for one of two reasons. Either A, it's not my interest, or B, I thought it was something else. And so when that happens, don't fall into the trap of, because it took me so long to get here, I need to stay. No one needs to stay. There are no seatbelts in the tables that I speak of. Get up and walk away, no matter how long it took you to get there, because that is your self-determination, is knowing when, you know, this doesn't apply to me. I speak in my book that I wanted to go to law school. Well, guess what? I wasn't cut out for law school. I think the highest grade that I got in law school was maybe a C+, you know, either a C+ or D-. I didn't do well. I didn't understand the rule against perpetuity or the unborn widow or any of that stuff. And so, therefore, I didn't do well. I already had a master's degree, and I decided to get up and leave. Now, it took me years to want to try to get into law school. And so I could have said, you know what, I put all this energy and all this effort, and let me stay. But that would have been a mistake. The smart answer is, I don't belong at this table. Let me go find a different table where I excel at. And that was in the table of business. And so I got up and went somewhere else. So That is probably the best advice that I can give, is that you do an assessment. Hopefully you, you got to the right table. But if not, there are plenty of tables in the world to go to. Find the one where you can do the best, the most good, and that's going to fulfill you the most.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I never really thought too much about it. I mean, I did that report in eighth grade, What Do You Want to Be When You Grow Up? And I interviewed a broadcaster who was also a character actor on a local TV kids show back in Phoenix. And for some reason, I did that report, but be on the radio? I dreamed about that as I was listening to guys as I was a kid growing up with the little transistor radio that I was given one Christmas. Stick that under my pillow, real low volume, and I could listen to this all night long and wake up to it in the morning if the batteries held out. But when I got into grade school or got into high school, I kind of forgot all about that. And it wasn't until I got into junior college and someone said, hey, you know, there's this radio station for the blind and visually impaired starting up. You know, you ought to check that out. And again, it was more, I needed a job for work study.
And
here I am today, nearly 40 years later. 40? Really? I remember the age of 40, vaguely. I have to say for myself, it was never really a conscious choice, but I do know that a lot of folks, they really, do you find that the folks that you come across, they struggle because they are using the disability that they happen to have as sort of the filter through which they make their decision?
That's a difficult question, and I'll tell you why. I'm going to give you a bad answer.
Okay.
Right now, it is a bad answer. You said something early on in your broadcast about people who don't want to hire people with disabilities. No, people don't want to hire people with disabilities who their entire identity is being disabled. Nobody wants that, right? You want to hire a person who fits the job description that you're hiring them for, that they've applied for a position for. Sometimes people, because they've been dealt a bad deck, because they've been dealt a raw hand, and maybe they don't have the support system to tell them, you can do this, you're the best, you'll be fine, you'll get there. Their cup is half empty, so they go to these interviews and they go to these job fairs and they go to these interviews or they go on these dates. We have to go out of the realm of work and go into social life with their cup being half empty. And so I think that I can't help someone feel that way. I would try to the best of my ability to encourage people to try not to feel that way. And you need to realize as a person of the human race that everybody bleeds blue, or everyone bleeds red. I mean, the blood is actually blue, but it comes into the air, it's red. So I like to, everyone has blood in their veins, and everyone hurts the same way, and everyone wants to laugh, and everyone wants to love, and everyone wants to participate, and everyone wants to belong. So I would say that, you know, I've seen that, you know, people's behavior, and sometimes they feel they can't get there. I feel bad for those individuals because, I can't help it that people were mean to you and that they gave you a short end of the stick, but you have to try to overcome that. Be able to move forward because people want to be your friend, but you have to give them a reason, not an excuse not to. And sometimes people with disabilities hold on to a crutch that comes across to those who aren't familiar with your disability as woe is me, pity me, and people just don't like that. They don't like that.
I can definitely relate to that and agree with that because you run across that a lot. I remember back in 1995, actually it was late 95, early 96, I was actually working in a warehouse where they basically stored and distributed light bulbs. Now this was for the military, but this was a private sector endeavor. Now you're going to be shocked probably at the folks who ran it, or I should say who maintained it. Blind and visually impaired folks. I kid you not, in a light bulb factory, or not factory, but warehouse. What was interesting about some of the stats, though, were the military, in its infinite wisdom, had it, their own distribution throughout the country to different places around the world. Their breakage rate was anywhere up to 25%. And over the course of time while I was there, our breakage rate, less than one. What was interesting was the fact that I was working there had great health benefits, to which allowed me to get a lens implant. But to what you've said, what I found was that at least one of the employees was rather verbal about his, once he found out this was happening to me, became very standoffish, even angry. I think even envious that I was going to get the opportunity to see better than I had before. And I guess I can understand that, because my ex-wife made a comment that shocked the daylights out of me. She said, "I hope I get to benefit from your new sight." And I didn't know exactly where that was coming from, but probably from the same place that one gentleman that I worked with was coming from. And so I find it interesting, too, that, I mean, you know, again, whether you're able-bodied or disabled, we still have the same emotional makeup inside. We're still made up psychologically in the same fashion. Not everybody's going to be happy for the news that, gee, they found a cure for cerebral palsy, JB. Isn't that exciting? You know, and maybe the folks that you know who have it aren't going to be quite so happy for you, or people who have other crippling conditions that they don't have a cure for aren't going to be real happy for you because they're still stuck. You find that?
I mean, again, you just can't, you know, that's just people. You just, you know, people always say to me, you know, well, Joseph, you are articulate. You speak well. But what about my child who is so-and-so or who has this disability or that disability or, you know, severe disability? And I always say, why do you go to the extreme? Look at the message. And the message that we want to focus on today is don't be upset with my success. You should be upset that it took so long for my success to happen because people have a negative perception about people's disabilities and what they're able to accomplish. In other words, you got to turn it on its head. It's not me saying, I was taken advantage of by having to prove myself that I could do something. But let's face it. If I didn't have the tenacity, if I didn't have an ego the size of Manhattan, I would have been in some wheelchair in the corner, on Medicaid, because that is the expected. He's got cerebral palsy. He can't. He's got brain damage. But it cannot be. We've got to stop with preconceived notions of people's illnesses, whether it's cerebral palsy, whether it's brain cancer, whether it's high blood pressure, whether it's diabetes. We just can't. And so what I would say to people that whose cup is half empty, you don't do yourself or anyone around you a favor by reminding people that you're disabled. Remind them that you're you, and then they'll figure out the rest on their own.
You know, I never told anybody when I was working at that first long-term job, the Christian Station, for 15 years, that I was legally blind, although I had my magnifying glass with me and so forth. But I was queuing records up at that point. I was queuing them up pretty quickly, and I didn't need. I certainly still looked close and so forth. And we didn't have computers then either. And somebody actually asked the question when they observed me. And that's when I told them, and they said, "Really? I didn't know that." And I'd been working there for many years with this person. What are your thoughts on viewing a disability as a perceived limitation?
Well, I mean, the reality. Meaning again, I can own a basketball team. I can own a baseball team. And I'm not going to be a starting center. I'm not going to hit cleanup. You know, I'm not going to hit cleanup, no matter how much I want to own the Montreal Expos. You know, I'm just not going to play. That was a joke, by the way. I'm just not going to play baseball. just not going to happen.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that I can't have a love for baseball. It doesn't mean that I can't have a, as a general manager, as a broadcaster. So I think that's where I would make the distinction. Like, you have to be honest with your limitations, you know. And again, there are able-bodied people who walk around the world who have limitations, but because they don't have a DSM diagnosis attached to the limitation, they are considered able-bodied. But they can't be a model, and they can't hit a 99-mile-an-hour fastball either. So I think it's something you have to put it in perspective. It's more pronounced if you have a visual disability. You have a limitation.
Mm-hmm.
Accept the limitation and move on.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's interesting, and I do understand what you're saying, because I have the great love of baseball. People during the World Series, they were asking me, are you a Dodger fan? Are you rooting for them? I said, well, I suppose, considering the fact they knocked off the D-backs at the beginning of the playoffs.
Right.
You know, and I have my World Series town. I can say that. I thank God I can say that I'm from Phoenix and I'm from a World Series town. I just love the game. I don't care who's playing. If there's a game on TV and I happen to flip it on, I'll sit and watch it, you know, because I just love the sport. But could I play it?
Right.
Oh, my God. In grade school, oh, I hated when we had to play softball. It didn't matter, softball or baseball, because the ball was still hard to find once it was hit. And I was never certain where it was going. And I was always placed in the outfield, typically. And it was even worse when I went to go to bat. Oh, but made it through. I found my strengths in track and field, primarily because of the bullies. Instead of standing and fighting, I learned to run and avoid punishment. But you're right. You find your strengths. I think that's the best part, as opposed to. But you also need to know what your real limitations are. And you and I both would agree that neither of us have the physical capabilities of playing baseball. I'd be getting hit all the time. I'd be one of those guys that'd be put on first base automatically because I'd be leaning in too far.
That's funny.
But it's fascinating to me how we there's almost the sense that we treat the community that is not normal or that has disabilities almost to the same degree that we treat our elderly population. And I'm not sure if other cultures in millennia gone by have done that. I've always been reading where they embrace them. And of course, back then, most of the people who had disabilities probably didn't survive long just because, well, again, you didn't have what we have today as far as, you know, medical breakthroughs and so on and so forth. Everybody has a contribution to make, right?
Correct.
Talk to us about some of the contributions that you have found that folks have made that you have come across in your travels, especially, and maybe more specifically, maybe as you've been out and promoting, taking your place at the table.
Well, thank you for the question. First of all, everyone likes a success story. So I, the upper hand that I have is that I said I would write a book. I wrote a book. The book matches the stories of my life that I went through. People's negative perception of people with cerebral palsy and their abilities allowed me to create a book. I didn't know when these experiences were happening to me. I can assure you, when I had tears running down my cheeks at the age of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, trying to understand why people would treat me differently, right? I didn't know that it would allow me to become a business owner and a successful speaker and have a book. So that's the benefit of that negative behavior. Because I just I, I don't know how else to say it, but the reality is I never believed that I was disabled. I never felt that I was disabled. I was never scared to ask someone out on a date because I walk with a cane and they don't. There is a perception, I will tell you, there is a perception that because I have a disability, people gravitate towards wanting to set me up with people who have a disability. I can't go out with someone who the only thing I have in common with them is that they have a disability. That's not going to work. So people do want these kind of things, and you just have to overlook them and realize that people sometimes act silly. They just act silly. I will say this. Society has moved forward. I mean, I was born in 1969. We're now in 2017, moving on to 2018. there's a greater awareness that I don't think that I speak alone when I say that people understand that you can either be able-bodied or disabled. I think there is a cultural norm of that reality. And you see that on television. You see that in Broadway shows. And, you know, people with disabilities are front and center. So to answer your question, as I'm promoting the book and as I'm speaking, it's more of a very positive sense for me. As, hey, I guess I've made it, you know. Doesn't mean that I get to rest on my laurels. It just means that, you know, my product is here. People with disabilities do have a voice, and I'm proud to represent that voice. I don't speak for anyone. I speak for myself, but I'm proud to include myself in the disabled community and as part of the parent community and as part of the business community as a person who lives with a disability. So I don't know if that answered the question, but that's kind of what I've seen from since I've moved on as an author and business owner around the country.
Well, what I glean is that you know, there are folks who, as we've already reiterated a number of times, they have a disability. I will say that there are those who have disabilities, even though they're able-bodied, especially those who, for whatever reason, they feel that, I can park anywhere I want. And they do. And I just go, okay, you have the mental, you have a mental lapse of understanding and compassion. And we want to teach you a little bit about that. Do not key the car. Just be kind and just reiterate that, hey, these spots are reserved for folks who genuinely need them. I actually pulled into one once. I don't have a tag. I don't have a handicap tag. I pulled into it by mistake, and I realized my mistake, and I started backing out. And I said, "Hey, it's okay. I'm getting out of here. I pulled in too soon. There was a spot available right next to it. just had to work on my angling a little bit more." This is, to me, an interesting subject that I think folks need to really, really research and really need to become a part of our entire society. For the very fact that, you know, this is where we are today. Who knows where we'll be tomorrow. And we encourage you folks to go to takingyourplaceatthetable.com. Takingyourplaceatthetable.com. That's the website. That's the title of the book, Taking Your Place at the Table. It is the art of refusing to be an outsider. Talk to me a little bit. How is this, from your perspective, JB, how is this an artistic endeavor? How is this in that respect?
If I understand the question correctly, I mean, I wrote the book to memorialize stories between my father and myself. That was the goal. And then as I started to put stories together in the book, I realized, hey, I actually have a voice to teach people you know, different scenarios. You can take any chapter of my book, and it could be a standalone topic that you can explore about an experience that happened to me and how I either resolved it or failed it. Failure is still okay. You're allowed to fail. But if you learn nothing from the failure, then you're going to repeat the same mistake over and over again. So, and so again, back to the issue of the table, then that's when you need to know when you need to leave the table. Yeah, I think that would be my answer. That I I promoted the book the best way that I can, and the goal of the book was really to memorialize slavery between my father and myself. It happens to be that I've had a great life. I continue to have a great life based on the fact that, again, my cup is half full. I wish I could teach people how to think the way I think. I mean, I've been blessed that I think that way. I want to use social. Let's move away from the business world for a second. Let's talk about the social dynamics of life. I'm currently divorced, and so I'll use that as an analogy. There's no one that I won't ask out on a date because I mean, I can't ask them out because of X, Y, and Z. I won't ask them out because I have nothing in common with them, but not because of some superficial or unattainable goal, or there's no club that I'm not going to show up at because I wasn't invited to, but I really want to belong to. Again, do your homework. Find out what the club is about. Why do you want to be there? How are you going to participate? And that's the goal of the book. The art of refusing to be an outsider is yourself. It's yourself.
What is, if I might ask, your spiritual proclivities? What's your background in that regard?
So I was born. I'm what is known as a Sephardic Jew. Jews from Arab lands, from Morocco, from North Africa, and they moved from Morocco. It was a huge migration of Jews from Morocco to Canada in 1958, and I lived in Montreal until 1987, where I went to college. I went to Israel for the year, and then I went to Yeshiva University, where I majored in political science and social work. Yeshiva University is the largest, oldest university of Jewish hospices in New York, where I got both my political science degree, my bachelor's of arts in political science, and my master's in social work in community organization at Yeshiva. And I currently serve on the board of overseers of the undergraduate college of Yeshiva University. So that's my bio in terms of task-oriented practicing of Judaism. But overall, I would say that, like every gentleman pushing 50, you take stock in your life, and your spiritual journey takes ebbs and flows. I'm a religious man. I'm not so sure that I'm as observant as I once was. But I definitely believe that it's God's will that you're a guest, and he will allow you to stay here for as long as he sees fit, and that you are a guest. So I have reverence for God. I'm not sure that I have fear, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about it in my book. Again, for those who are listening who might not know the particular nuances of Orthodox Judaism, of which I used to practice, Orthodox Judaism says that you cannot ride on the Sabbath. You cannot ride in a car on the Sabbath. So I write in my book that as I got older, I don't believe that Orthodox Judaism is equitable with the rest of reality of people with disabilities. It doesn't make any sense to me that someone who uses two canes to walk and to maximize their independence should have to get soaking wet in the rain to walk the temple when the amount of energy and exertion to get there is just that much greater. And it just doesn't make sense to me. Now, I'm a mortal human being. God has his reasons, and the rabbis have their reasons. But I kind of take a step back, and because you asked the question, I followed it through. I take a step back in my book, and I become intellectually honest. I'm very proud of that thought process, to become intellectually honest. And I just say, look, I'll take up, if I'm wrong, then I'll take up my beef with God, after 120 years, after I meet him in heaven. But for right now, this is kind of how I view life. And I would say, with no disrespect to any religion, because the only one that I know well is Judaism, I would say that, again, the human beings, the clergy behind religion, at the end of the day, they're human beings. And unless they've lived your experience, they're human, and they might give you an answer, not intentionally, that's offensive, it's not they didn't do it on purpose. You have to give them a path, and then you have to kind of find your way. I think that's how I became religious versus observant.
How has your Judaism affected or impacted or influenced the path that you've chosen in being this, what I'll term, advocate for the disabled?
Well, Judaism at its core has a belief, at the core of Judaism. You know, Mario Cuomo, the former governor of New York, was once asked, "Do you feel about being the governor of a state that has the oldest, longest Jewish university under Jewish auspices in its state?" And he goes, "You need to ask me, how do I feel about the people that believe in Tikkun Olam?" There's a concept in Judaism known as repairing the world. We believe that we were put on this earth for one purpose, and the purpose is to make the world a better place. Right? Some people confuse that, and it's a wrong concept to say that we are the chosen people. Get rid of that nonsense. But yeah, we were chosen to do good. We were chosen to repair the world. Not that we're better than you, but rather that we have a defined mission in the world. And so that is, you will find the people of your faith, get involved in building hospitals, building federations, building social service programs. Because it's in our core value to serve, and so that to be community minded, the community spirit. So that has maintained, no matter whether or not my religious observance has diminished, my desire for Jewish communal advocacy has continued. So I think that is something that is very much embedded in Jewish culture.
It's always interesting to hear the background stories of our guests here on the program as we fast approach the end of our program, and find out those influences, as I like to refer to it, the catalyst, if you will, that propelled one forward. And obviously your catalyst was back at the age of six, I would have to say, predominantly, where you said, "Oh, I'm not going down this road. I want to be, as you use the wonderful metaphor, I want to be at that table. And I want to partake."
Correct.
"Just like everybody else. So, you know, why should I be denied access?" And so here you are today. And I think that a real important aspect, and I've experienced this amongst specifically the blind and visually impaired. I've noticed there are a lot of folks that I've come across who they've embraced or at least accepted who they are and what they are and how they are physically, mentally, emotionally, and so forth. But there are probably just as many who are just as embittered. I've come across a lot of folks who are just angry at the world. One in particular who shared with me that they were upset about the fact that the sighted world won't accommodate the visually impaired. And of course, I'm looking around at all of the facilities that I'm associated with, Radio Reading Service and the Braille Institute and the Recordings for the Blind and on and on and on and on. I'm thinking, where do you not see accommodation here? But they're just angry because they can't have what the sighted world has. And I've always felt, and this was even, I mean, when I first got into broadcasting, and I learned this lesson at a broadcast school where the engineers who kept the equipment running, they actually took an old tube type amplifier, just a stereo amplifier, and they were able to convert it into a console for radio broadcasting. And I was like, wow. And so that's where I came up with this philosophy. Work with what you have until you get what you want. And over the course of time in my life and career, that's exactly what has happened. I have basically worked with those things that, all right, so they were maybe circa 1950 or 1960 equipment. They were still working. And they were doing well. And then I went to work for a station where they had equipment was at least 1970s or maybe early 80s. And then here we are in the computer age and, you know, you almost don't need a console. So I've lived by that philosophy. That's probably one of the first ones I ever came up with was work with what you have until you get what you want. And You know, you just never know what you're going to discover. And of course, necessity, they say, is the mother of invention. And look at some of the great inventions that have come about over the last 100 or plus years. It's just incredible. It really is. I want to thank you so much for taking so much time to share with us here on the program. This has been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you very much.
I also want to encourage you, should you find yourself out here on the Central Coast in Santa Barbara, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. I think that it needs to be continued. I think that people need to discuss this more and more because it's something that is not going to go away, because we're going to continue to have people who are not going to be able to function normally in our society. They're going to need some support and some encouragement. And to that community also, if you need help, go ahead and ask for it. It's okay. Especially the guys, right?
Correct. I will tell you, I used to not, I'll leave you with this idea and this thought, and it's from a story in my book. I went on a fantastic date. Unfortunately, the woman and I didn't feel we were compatible, but I went on a fantastic date with a woman who is a quadriplegic.
Mm-hmm.
And she just happens to be a quadriplegic. That's why I went on a date with her. I want to make clear we make that distinction. And I noticed that she was not afraid to ask for help. And I said, wow, you don't mind asking for help. She goes, Joseph, the only person who suffers when you don't ask for help is you. People are willing to help. You just have to ask. Well, believe it or not, until I went on a date with this individual, I used to not ask people to get me coffee, because I can't get coffee for someone else. I can't carry babies or hot coffee because of the way I walk. So, but I learned from watching someone else, realize that the only way they can maximize their independence is by asking for help. So even I, you know, this self-proclaimed expert Richard, you made me an expert on being on your show this morning. But I learned from watching others ask for help, and so that's probably the best lesson that I get. My takeaway from today's show: it's no crime. The only dumb question is the one you don't ask.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to ask for some help, go ahead. It's a good starting point.
Exactly, exactly. And everybody has the opportunity, and I encourage people to take advantage of that opportunity, regardless of what your status is. And again, JB, I want to thank you so much. Before I let you go, I have three final questions that I'd like to ask you that I ask all of my guests. And the first one is, and I'm going to keep this one in this context, who is JB?
JB at his core is an advocate. It's what I do best. It's in my blood. It's how I think. I'm going to figure it out for you. I'm going to figure it out for me. I'm going to figure it out for those who want help at my core.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I'm very happy with what I'm doing. In other words, I just want to be able to be blessed with the ability to have the health to continue to be able to do what I'm doing and to be able to maintain the resources that I've been able to grow to continue to do what I'm doing. I'm very happy with where I'm at.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My life's purpose, again, is to be a good person, is to be, and that's a catch-all phrase, but really is to be an advocate. I want people to learn from watching my behavior. I don't know that I've learned early on that people pay attention to what I'm doing because I'm very noticeable. I can never work as a private investigator because when I walk, you hear my cane, you hear my shoes. I mean, I am loud. There's no question. And so I noticed early on that people pay attention to what I'm doing. And so I want them to learn a positive aspect of a person who lives with a disability. So I am very conscious of that.
Joseph, again, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. We greatly appreciate it, and also the work that you are doing. And we encourage people to go to your website for this particular work. And we're talking about takingyourplaceatthetable.com, the art of refusing to be an outsider. And again, JB, thank you for joining us I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.